evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is June 9, 2016. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Events coming up. I'm headed to Zurich and Lake Constance in southern Germany for the second 2 weeks of July. I'm seeing Puccini's Turandot at the Lake Constance Outdoor Opera, which is very exciting to me. Puccini is my favorite, and Turandot is my favorite Puccini. So I'm also going to take from Zurich a one-day trip to Amsterdam. So between Zurich and Amsterdam, if anyone wants to have a lunch, just let me know and we'll see what we can arrange. Our theme tonight is Mirror, Mirror on the Wall, Who is the Fairest of Them All? I have a commentary by that name that I published this week. It's in response to the fact that we have a number of people deeply rich as a result of the financial coup d'etat and engineering the financial coup d'etat, making pronouncements about what's wrong with the general economy and what to do about it. And it reflects an extraordinary ignorance on their part, whether it's ignorance of their own role in things or the general population's ignorance. They don't seem to understand that the sort of 10% productive leadership within the population knows a great deal more than they think. And I believe in the field there are no secrets. What's remarkable is they either don't see the full game, they may just be doing what they're told. But there's a major reality gap because you have just so many people now pretending that we had a financial crisis instead of a financial coup d'etat. That's a major bubble. And it's a denial that leads to all the wrong solutions. If you can't diagnose the problem, then the solutions just contribute to more of the same, which has destroyed productivity. And then the other major reality gap is you have whole sectors of the economy that have enjoyed unbelievably cheap subsidized cost of capital, and they have no concept of the harm that was done to generate that cheap cost of capital, including a lot of organized crime activities and financial fraud. And the general population isn't ignorant of that. So, the populist horde is trying to tell them something they need to hear, and the question is, how do we get that communication going? This is all exacerbated by the fact that Clinton is now the Democratic nominee, and you see a series of Democrats, including the president, now coming out and endorsing her. It's why I wanted to have Wayne Madsen on soon, and Dr. Daddy Cherry, who's a Haitian, who we're going to be talking about disaster capitalism in Haiti, and I should include in that not only disaster capitalism, but disaster philanthropy. Anyway, I want them to help you understand the tactics that are being used both here and abroad, the sort of soft weapons, soft revolution, and lots of top-down control and manipulation and theft, basically under the guise of we are here to help you. I did a review of Dr. Cherry's book, We Have Dared to Be Free, on the sort of the invasion of, and foreign control of Haiti after the earthquake in 2010. Essentially what we're watching going on in the United States is the establishment saying F you to the productive members of the general population. I don't think the global establishment understands how much destruction of productivity there is going on, legitimate productivity. While we see great concern, Greenspan standing up and saying, productivity is flatlined. Well, of course, when you destroy people's productivity in all the different ways that it's being destroyed, that's exactly what happens. So the global establishment does not seem to understand and is lacking a mirror. And the question is, how do we create that communication? It sort of reminds me of when I did the Kemp tape. Some of you may remember the story when the litigation started between my firm, Hamilton Securities, and the federal government. My attorneys asked me to record all the recollections I had of working in the Bush administration. What came out later was they had tried to falsely frame me several times, and all the false frames had failed. And the point of getting me to give basically turn over a complete recollection of all my experiences as Assistant Secretary of Housing was the thinking that they could frame me for something that I did as Assistant Secretary. I suspect those tapes pretty quickly ended up at the CIA. But the theory was they could frame me for something I did because they can control the administration, so it'd be much easier to frame me on something like that. What's interesting is as soon as that info got to wherever it went to, we were also asked for copies by various people who wanted to listen. And it ended up developing a camp following on the internet, and us finally having to put up copies on the internet because we got sick of making so many cassettes. It was hundreds of cassettes that went out. It got very popular. I suspect, and as I said, several politicians, I think, disappeared from high office as a result of those tapes circulating. And so what was expected to be used to probably frame me instead turned out to be quite a wake-up call to the powers that be that have no idea what's really going on in the trenches. So honest feedback from the trenches about what's really going on can be shocking and sobering. Our lies often blind the liars to the truth. And, you know, you've heard me say it before. I'll say it again. Those who play in a rigged game get stupid. Anyway, money and markets. The big issue right now in the marketplace is Brexit. Britain is voting on whether or not to exit the European Union on June 23rd. The polls are neck and neck right now. The Economist is running polls, and we'll keep that link to the Economist polls at the top of geopolitical. 43% now say leave, 42% stay. If you dig down and look at the numbers among different groups, the rich want to stay, the poor want to leave. It's very much the poor being against centralization and against immigration, as those two things are not only working against them, but working against preserving any kind of productive culture the way they're going down. The Brexit vote, if Britain should vote to leave, there's going to be another referendum by Scotland. And the question is if Scotland, who would like the UK to stay in the EU, but if they leave, is Scotland then going to leave the UK? It's going to be very interesting to see what happens. There are big concerns in the Europe financial system. If Brexit votes yes, you're really going to see Teutonic plate shift. And then the question is, in the elections in France and Germany next year, will the European Union hold, or will it have to reconfigure into a Northern European group? Not surprisingly, we see Germany bringing back the army. So Pew did a study, and that link is also up on the website, showing what the sort of response to or support for the EU was throughout Europe. Let me just read one of their conclusions. The institution's strongest backers of the poll, 72%, the Hungarian 61%, and many other nations support is tepid. Just 27% of the Greeks, 38% of the French, 47% of the Spanish have a favorable opinion of the EU. Notably, 44% of the British view the EU favorably, including 53% of the Scottish. 38% support from the French is not a very good sign. So, and again, we have the French elections in 2017. What we're seeing both in the EU and the United States is that the productive members of the general population are fed up with things that lower their productivity and skim and steal their savings. And the gripes of the productive members of the general population are quite legitimate. If anything, their culture reflects a deep understanding of what productivity is and what habits need to happen to be productive, and they appreciate what the assault on their culture means. It was interesting when I was in the Australian Leadership Forum, many people in that group could not fathom the corruption that was really happening in the U.S. general population, and the Americans who were there, I think, were in a bit of a state of denial about it. Anyway, so Brexit will come on top of a slowdown in the world economy. And over the last week, since last week's Money and Market, we've seen really a chorus of voices announcing everything from global slowdown to recession to even more dire warnings. The World Bank has issued a dismal outlook for the global economy. That comes last week when I talked about OECD, Japan, and IMF doing the same. But the World Bank is basically warning of risk of a sharp slowdown and cut its growth forecasts. I put up a link to several, sort of a summary and charts from the Wall Street Journal describing the World Bank projection. One of the things they show is that now at the global slowdown rates, it's going to take much longer for the emerging markets and the frontier markets to catch up with the G7 nations in terms of per capita. What they don't mention, which I think is very important to understand, is that per capita convergence is not a global phenomenon. It's an Asian phenomenon. Asia, India, and China are really on a trajectory to close the gap between their per capita income and the G7 nations. But the rest of the emerging markets doesn't look even close. So convergence right now is an Asian phenomena. What's happening in the G7 countries is that productivity is really flatlining for a number of reasons. And the second quarter wrap-up is going to be focused on productivity and prosperity and what we do about it. So I'll defer to then. One of the things they noted is causing tremendous market uncertainty and dampening investments, and surveys of the companies indicate this as well, is political tensions in the U.S. and Europe. Needless to say, what's happened in the U.S. Presidential election is, I would say, deeply dampening of businesses' desire to take risks. So politics has clearly entered a danger zone in many places for many reasons. But I'll give you a perfect example. Next week, we're going to publish Dr. Laura Thompson's interview on how to handle toxic vaccines. Laura had, when I interviewed her, had just seen Vaxxed, and we'll post on Saturday our Just a Taste video, which describes seeing Vaxxed as in response to a very strong recommendation that she gave it. I went online and watched a lot of the interviews. Apparently, after many of the screenings, the producers and some of the mothers who are in the movie, as well as people very active or people interviewed and active in this area of the connection between vaccinations and autism, are interviewed. So I watched a whole series of interviews this week. So let me give you some statistics. There is one projection in Vaxxed from an MIT researcher, very credible doctor. One out of two American children is expected to be autistic by 2032 if we continue with the current heavy schedules and the rate of growth of autism continues. 80% out of it's much more likely for boys to have become autistic than girls. 80% of boys will be autistic by 2032 is the projection. And four times more African Americans than whites get, or boys get autism. The numbers are quite astonishing. And what you're talking about doing is when one mother mentions that when a family has an autistic child, it's a $5 million hit. They also mention they're in the process of hiring an attorney because their child is about to turn 18. And unless she gets the courts to appoint her the ward of her child, the child will become a ward of the state. She says they're building institutions to house all these different wards of the state as autistic children turn to 18. It's very, very chilling. And if you look at the impact that this is having on families, so let's just assume it's only one out of five kids that has autism. That's a $5 million hit to one out of five families, just the financial ramifications alone are devastating. Now, at the same time that we're rolling out a vaccination policy and mandates of vaccinations that will basically destroy and wipe out the male population, we are promoting women as leaders in business and government. If you look at the combination of that, and you add to that all the things that are being done to drive up the cost of capital to small business, massive increase in regulatory burdens on small business, taxation, on and on and on. You're talking about a massive attack on the productive members of society, and you know the kind of things that can absolutely devastate them, devastate marriages, devastate households. So it's a perfect example of the many different things that are destroying productivity. But you're starting to see the general population realize, look, you know, if you look at what you're doing, you're basically making it impossible for us to function. Dare I mention transgender bathroom policies from the president. So these kinds of things are really putting politics into the danger zone. If you tell a state attorney general that a local principal has got to let the local bully into the girls' locker room whenever he wants to go there on the, you know, just because he says, oh, well, I feel like a transgender today. I mean, making it impossible to the for the principal to just even discipline and manage the school. So, you know, you're talking about some pretty psychopathic things here. Okay, there's other warnings from different, not just governmental agencies. JP Morgan Chase warning about the possibility of a recession, market turndown. Goldman doing the same. The one I take seriously, because I don't pay attention to those guys too much, is there's a serious comment from Kiplinger last Friday. Kiplinger's the master of always saying, no, it's going to slow burn, it's not going to collapse. But this time around, Kiplinger said, no, you know, we're in a serious slowdown, and if things don't get handled right, we could get a serious turndown. So Kiplinger is also flashing, you know, warning signs, which is not good. So let's visit the markets. The U.S. dollar took a real nosedive on the employment report, and Yellen's saying she's probably not going to raise interest rates. We'll see what she does next week. So the U.S. dollar index is now down almost 5% for the month. It's still 93.99, so it's essentially at 94. Remember, we've been trading in a band from 92 to 100. As long as it doesn't break either side of that band, I think we're just in the same old, same old. If the U.S. dollar breaks below 92 and stays below, then we're in a whole different ball game. So remember, if we break 92 and stay through, you need to check back in here with Money and Markets. Let's look at the bond market. TLT now up 12.35% this year. That's the strongest it's been. That's a very strong response. You're seeing big global demand for long treasuries, and that's a very, very deflationary sign. Who could have believed that we would juice 13 or almost 12.5% out of the long treasury this year? The intermediate treasury ETF now up almost 6%. The aggregate bond ETF up 4.14%, and junk bonds, high yield ETF, this is baffling, up 7.43%. That's over a 22% swing. It was down more than 15% earlier in the year. The S&P ETF now almost 5% for the year, and given what the forward earnings are and the amount of debt corporations have issued to buy shares, it's just stunning to me, because the earning fundamentals are not supportive of much movement up in the market. If anything, a major correction down. U.S. real estate up 7.14%. We're seeing sector changes in how the U.S. stock market sectors are managed, which may bring more money into REITs. U.S. home builders now in the positive territory, 0.86% for the year. So I think there's going to be a real effort to keep the stock market bouncing along coming into the conventions at the end of July. Then the question is, after the conventions, can they continue it through the election? I'm not sure. Depends how much they want to make sure Clinton wins. They need the Democrats to look good on the economy, and the problem is the fundamentals are poor. Okay, Europe now up 5.73% for the year. That's a big improvement. Germany still down 0.69%. That's the German ETF. Developed markets away from North America are now flat. They're up 0.24% for the year. China, the decision that we went through last year about will the China A-shares be included in the MSCI index decision, that's coming up. If they say yes, we could see big new inflows into the Chinese stock markets. But their large cap Chinese ETF is now off minus 2.13% for the year, and the small caps minus 8%. The emerging markets come back. I was amazed. I thought we were going the other way, but they're back up 6.87%. I'm still concerned about whether, you know, that can swing the other way. Oil now up 8% for the year. So a meaningful recovery in oil at this point. Gold up 19.51%. Silver up 24.87%. Lots of interest in short-term trades on the precious metals mining stocks, because some of the big hedge fund buyers have been buying. And big charts from Rambus this week on the precious metals. He's gone into precious metals this week, particularly ones below a dollar. So highly leveraged. I think it's a short-term trade, and I think you need to be very, very careful, because precious metals, given the deflationary signs, could very much go the other way. The California primary, we saw obviously Donald Trump sort of lock up the nomination as a result of his complete sweep with everybody else out of the race. Clinton swept California by much better than I expected. What was very interesting was Greg Palast had several pieces about vote rigging. It looked to me like the vote rigging in California was really over the top. I had one subscriber report in the San Francisco Bay Area, very wealthy San Francisco suburb. They went to the polls at 7 a.m. in the morning. There were 12 people standing in line in front of them. They said in their neighborhood the signs were 8 signs for Sanders to every 2 for Clinton, very Democratic area. And 4 of the 12 people weren't on the ballot and couldn't vote, even though some of them had mailings confirming that they were on the ballot. They were all the 4 that were kind of thrown out and given provisional ballots, which don't get counted to much later, were seniors, which, and it wouldn't surprise me if it was Bernie Sanders getting Social Security back on the agenda. Obama in 2012 was planning on cutting or shaving Social Security, and it was Bernie Sanders who fought back and insisted that finally the president go the other way, which he just did. This last week, he endorsed an expansion of Social Security for the first time. So Sanders has been a major force to support and upgird Social Security. So it doesn't surprise me that the seniors suddenly can't vote. Anyway, I think if there had been an honest vote in California, Sanders would have probably won. But coming into that, the Tuesday sweep, whether it was the sudden surprising turnaround in the stock market or media pumping Clinton or signs of election fraud, it looked to me like the deep state really pulled out all the stops for Clinton. And it lends credence to the theory that Trump's being used to white out the Republicans and make Clinton look acceptable. Trump helped that by falling into his own mess, attacking the judge on his Trump University trial. The danger here is that Trump's going to be used to sort of gather up the men who are highly productive and sort of frustrated about what's being done to destroy their productivity. Trump expressing their anger, and he sort of organizes and catches them offsides in a way that's just going to help Clinton and sort of the beatdown that Clinton represents. It's a very ugly picture, but it's how the deep state has used women and women's lib to play that game many, many times before. Anyway, we'll have to see how it plays out. What I'm hoping for is that at least what Trump can do is bring transparency. So if you look at the disapproval rates of Trump and Clinton and the dirt available on Trump and Clinton, we could get quite an indictment on the American establishment if we get a serious food fight. And frankly, that could be relatively positive. Interestingly enough, there was a great subscriber pointed me to a column in the Financial Times Lunch with James Baker. Baker's feeling honest this day. He gave away several things. Let me just read you some quotes from the article. Remember, he's talking to a Financial Times senior reporter. Hillary Clinton was never given anything to do. She was just there at the State Department to run for president, says Baker. I would describe the turn of his phrase, making it clear that it was the deep state who was telling people what to do in allocating responsibilities in the administration rather than the president. Quote, and this is Baker speaking, "I won't get my panties in a wedge because of what I'm hearing from the political candidates. What they say in the campaign and what they do once they're in the White House are not the same thing. I don't care who wins, whoever gets to the White House. Presidents can do a lot, but they can only do so much through the system of checks and balances. We are countries of laws limited by bureaucracy and the power structure in Washington. Presidents are not unilateral rulers. If they do not know that, they will soon find out, or they will find out soon enough." Okay, so let me translate for you. What Baker's saying is, this is entertainment. Don't worry about it. These people are puppets, and they will do what we tell them to do. He's getting a little honest in his later years. Interestingly enough, the Bilderbergers are meeting right now. One of the few good signs of good news is Peggy Noonan of the Wall Street Journal was invited to the Bilderbergers. And I suppose, I hope she gets a platform there to give some legitimate feedback about destruction of productivity, because she's, if anything, more and more in her column, she's representing the populist horde. I wanted to read you something from her column on June the 4th. And remember, this is the leading, I believe, the leading editorial writer in the Wall Street Journal. An anecdote. 2 years ago at a birthday party for a mutual friend, I bumped into a hedge fund billionaire who turned to me angrily and lashed out over something I'd written that he deemed to be insufficiently conservative. I listened, merely blinking with surprise. I'm sorry to say, and removed myself from his flight path. Afterward, I thought about how he must have come to view himself. He is, as I said, vastly wealthy, but also generous, giving time and money to think tanks, groups, candidates. He must view all of this, I thought, as a targeted investment. Maybe he sees himself as having a controlling investment. Maybe he thinks he bought conservatism. I felt in a sharp new way that my criticism of the donor class had been right. Inevitably, they see to their own enthusiasms and policy priorities. This was how the GOP became the party of "we don't care what Americans think about illegal immigration." Who do these Americans think they are? They think they own the place. Anyway, it's amazing to see a Wall Street Journal editorial writer so disgusted with what's going on that they increasingly represent the populist horde. If you look at the topics on the Burger Builders discussion list, it shows some of the concerns. One of the things they're talking about is cybersecurity, which is a real problem and serious taxation on the global economy. Reuters estimating it as costing more than $450 billion a year. Another is what is called precariat and middle class. That means middle class people who have wage insecurity and are really experiencing falling incomes and unemployment as a result of technological change. So that and growing inequality are clearly on everyone's minds. The other good news, in addition to Peggy Noonan getting a chance to educate the Bilderbergers about reality, is Sanders saying he's going to take his candidacy all the way to the convention. And the reason is Clinton really claims that she's got the nomination as a result of superdelegates, and it's frankly, the Democratic Party should be deeply ashamed. It's one of the most undemocratic things I've ever seen. And if you look at the superdelegates, if you look at the rigging of voting, if you look at all the sort of different games that are being played, to say that the Democratic Party is anything other than a fascist institution, ditto the Republican Party. I mean, we're looking at really fascism writ large. Our hero this week is Abraham Bolden, Secret Service agent to John F. Kennedy. He literally ended up in jail for 5 years trying to tell the truth about what was going on in the Secret Service at that time. Really sort of railroaded, and he's got an effort going now in his 80s to receive a presidential pardon. I've signed his petition. It's shocking how few votes or signatures he's gotten. I put up on the website under Wild Cards a very long, very good interview with him, an exceptionally impressive man. He describes how his spiritual faith really saved his life during the trials and tribulations, reminded me very much of my own experience. I was lucky I got my training in the African American churches, and as a result of sort of connections I had to that community growing up in an African American neighborhood and being raised by an African-American woman. And it just, you know, I'll say this once, I say it so many times, the people who have developed a spiritual practice and spiritual warfare that can defeat genocide are in that community. And there is a very precious resource there. And if you look at what's happening with vaccinations and all sorts of other policies to depopulate that group, I suspect it's because they do have that spiritual power. It's one of the things I want to talk with Dr. Cherry about when we discuss Haiti. Some runner-ups in the hero category, Muhammad Ali died this last week, and an extraordinary boxer and extraordinary hero. And we have several links about his life and death up on the website. And finally, John Oliver, lovely comedian who engineered the purchasing of $15 million of medical debt and then proceeded to promptly cancel it. I'm sure he brought relief to many people. I just hope he remembered to address the tax issues for forgiveness of indebtedness. And finally, in the hero category, I'd like to give a nod to the SeaWorld orca whale, who shocked the crowds by trying to attempt suicide in front of everyone. The story is in the website, and it's
Ask
I think it's a
Catherine.
metaphor
Thank you
for how
again
for the links and
a lot
articles.
Of people
I'm getting
right
recommendations
now,
given
for up to 40 and 50 books and documentaries
and
a month.
And if you look at the volume, the impingement
I try
on freedoms
and
of various
and watch
kinds,
a lot
both
of
for humans and animals.
Read and watch the full flow that comes in.
One good one that I did put up on the website is a new documentary about 9/11 called Incontrovertible, which is about the fall of Building 7 and the fact that the BBC on multiple occasions announced that Building 7 had fallen a significant time before it did. It's quite interesting to watch. Solomon Brothers was in Building 7 along with the SEC and some other government offices of agencies investigating fraud on and shenanigans on Wall Street. Solomon was sold by Buffett to Travelers in 1997-98, and then Travelers and Citibank merged. So you had sort of Buffett and Citibank's government and mortgage securities through 2001. There's a lot of juicy records in those offices. I've recently, so let me go to the first question. Catherine, I've recently received and have enjoyed reading the Solaria report entitled Space, Here We Go, Global Investment Takes Off. I'm hoping that you can continue to focus on the most promising companies that merit a closer look from a prospective investment standpoint. What plans do you have in that regard, and what can Solaria offer to further assist subscribers operationalize this information about 3.0 and the movement in the direction of the space economy? From a more terrestrial perspective, I continue to read with great interest about the increasing great strides being made to consolidate the efforts of European and Asian economic interests as manifest in the new Silk Road infrastructure mega project. So I'm also wondering if you've been able to accomplish anything similar as you've done Space 3.0 with respect to the new Silk Road. If not immediately, do you agree this would be a fruitful area of devoting time, effort, and study? I know we addressed this a little bit last week. We are updating the list of space companies that we published in the annual wrap-up. We're doing it on the new website that will be launched this summer, so it's not on the existing website. But when we launch the new one, we will have an updated list of space companies. We finished going through all the European ones and identified which are publicly traded. And now, right now, we're proceeding to go through all of the Asian space companies and identify which ones of those are publicly traded, although many of them appear to be only traded in Hong Kong or the Chinese markets or the Asian markets. So I would like by the end of the year to have identified all the publicly traded space-based companies, and I've been working on a screen to do joint through Solaria Investment Advisory Services with a money manager, a screen on two screens, one of which will be on the space-based economy. I would love to do the same thing for the Silk Road, but that would be a next year project. And it's going to be a little bit trickier because, again, many of those companies are not traded in the U.S. They're traded in the European or Asian markets. In follow-up to the following and prior question, please look at the following link, The Ultimate Credibility of the Source, notwithstanding. It's a link to something on the new Silk Road. Greetings. The link below from David Stockman, no implicit endorsement of credibility, reliability, or authenticity. Although one of his major touts is that David Stockman is the ultimate Washington insider turned iconoclast, he began his career in Washington as a young man, quickly rose, etc., etc., etc. Then he sends some links. This type of data reminds me of similar genre of data available via John Williams and his website, which appears to be very considered and thoughtful. I'd be interested to hear your views on the tension between government statistics and versus shadow statistics, a la John Williams, which in my experience is often at the heart of the inability to conduct an intelligent discussion between a principal and a current or prospective asset manager or an investment advisor, each of which parties may be utilizing, thus resulting in vastly different perspectives and reference points fundamentally conditioned by which data the particular party may be relying on. Indeed, many mainstream investment commentators and certainly the mainstream financial media present information that is predominantly relying upon government and or big business economic data and reporting. Does this fit into a variant of another form of fear porn? Who is to be believed? The government statistics are clearly manipulated and are not reliable. I think Williams does a very good job of trying to get at the real numbers. I'm a subscriber and big fan of his work, and as you can see from the archive, he's been on the Salieri Report several times, so I don't consider John fear porn at all. I consider him to be very, very credible. Now, both Stockman and Williams do convert what they see, including in terms of real numbers, into interpretations of what to expect that I don't agree with. So John Williams will often predict that the dollar is going to collapse or there's going to be hyperinflation. I don't agree with him. And I think that at the heart of the disagreement between us is I'm looking at the black budget and all the different things they have to keep the game going, and Williams is not looking at the same kind of covert information. So I keep saying it's not going to collapse, it's going to slow burn, or the dollar's going higher, or going to stay up. And frankly, that's what has happened. And I think it's because Williams kind of looking at the, you know, the real numbers on the overt economy, but there's a whole world of the hidden financial system and the black budget that he's not looking at or appreciating. Anyway, but I would say his statistics are very good, and I use them all the time. Greetings. I apologize for the relative disorganization of this inquiry, but the question engendered here are so broad and sweeping and diverse that I suppose the best way for the issues to be posed is to enumerate the various sub-issues. Then there's a long series of different questions about different stories on China, and essentially what the poster is referring to is a number of different phenomena. Let me describe them. First of all, there is massive cooperation between China and the U.S. behind the scenes. I would strongly recommend that if you want to understand that cooperation, you read Steve Rocha's book, Unbalanced. We have a great interview with Steve in the archives, and that's one of the best books on understanding the U.S.-China relationship. Another thing you're watching is that there is an effort globally to build out the global gold inventories and trading systems. It's part of moving towards a digital currency, and China is an important part of that. But you're watching a global gold trading system coming up and a rebalancing of the inventories. And that is at the heart. You know, there's competition inside of it, but it's a major cooperation, and I think coming top down. You're also seeing China go into space in a big way. They now have 100,000 more people in their space program than we do. As I say in my annual wrap-up, I believe that the reason we rebalanced the global economy was to create the capacity globally to free up enough capacity to go into space. So at the deepest level, I think there's enormous cooperation. If you watch the movie The Martian, you'll see an effort to really promote that kind of cooperation. Now, the Chinese are building out the military and satellite systems and financial systems they need to support and build out a global currency. And there's great competition about all of that. And so that's another part of the different stories that you're seeing. And there's tremendous tension as they do that, because as Roche describes, for a long time, they have been using their savings to basically buy treasuries and feed our consumerism. And now they're shifting and using their savings to build up the Silk Road and invest in the emerging markets and things that create capacity away from the United States. You know, whereas the first increased our power, the second diminishes our power, and there's tremendous tension. And it's what essentially China is restructuring its economy to be far more independent, and that restructuring is going to have a major reverberation on the global economy and global politics for quite some time to come. Part of that is that we have different trading partners that, as the size of China trades grows, that trade passes the U.S. in terms of dollar importance as partners to those trading partners. And that's why with Trans-Pacific Partnership and all these other agreements, we're trying to rope everybody back in and tie them into our system. And so the question comes up in the tensions with China, whose infrastructure, whose equity, you know, who's getting the equity pop out of different Chinese activities. And more they're saying they get the pop. So that's where the tension lies. But there's several things going on at the same time. Some are competitive, some are cooperative. And I think it's important to see the sort of deeper cooperative game going on behind the scenes, which I think is what you do see because you alluded to it. Somebody sent me a link for a piece by Samuel Bryan on why gold confiscation is highly unlikely today, and I agree with most of the points in the article. I think gold confiscation is highly unlikely to happen today. Someone also sent, "Hi, Catherine, I wanted to tell you how I manage watering plants. I use a pendulum and ask the plant if it wants water. It takes the guesswork out of it. It's a great idea. I'm in the middle of prototyping EMF protection devices with Jason Bond Smith, and it's very interesting. As a result, I've had a massive orchid revival. All my orchids, which had gone dormant, have suddenly all blossomed. So I've got orchids all over the house in beautiful bloom. So the question for me is, how do I make sure I water them properly?" So that's very good advice. "Dear Catherine, within our media, there seems to be a hierarchy of how things operate. It appears that the prestigious national news networks and media are the only ones who can break national news stories to everyone, and then the local news outlets can only repeat these same stories while remaining focused on delivering the local news. Is that your understanding of how our media system operates?" I don't really have an understanding of how the media operates. It's true that the local papers are essentially simply reprinting a lot of what they get from the centralized systems that feed them. There's surprisingly little local news in them, however. If a media source is not credible, I just don't use it other than to use it to track what the pro-centralization team is doing and saying. You get some news outlets, such as The Economist or The Wall Street Journal, that have good coverage of the overt economy, parts that are easily discussed on an open basis in the official reality. And because that's such a big part of the economy, they're very, very good and very useful. At the same time, there's a whole world of things they don't cover. So it's not a 0-1 issue, but if, I just don't worry about how the corporate media operates because I don't think it's credible. So, we had an important statistic that I put up on the website this week, an article saying that the people working in online media surpassed traditional media recently. Wouldn't surprise me if that's true. I think most of the problems that are happening in the world could only happen, they couldn't be happening without massive amounts of propaganda, mind control, and corrupt media. So I would recommend losing all interest in the corrupt media and what they do and how they do it. It's one of the most powerful acts that you and I can take. Let's go to the movies. I wanted to review the film 13 Hours about the six soldiers who, as contractors, fought to protect the U.S. State Department special mission compound in a nearby CIA station in Benghazi on September 11th, 2012. It was the attack where the U.S. ambassador to Libya, J. Christopher Stevens, was killed, along with his information officer and two other soldiers, both of whom were former Navy SEALs. The unanswered questions about, it's now simply referred to as Benghazi, as well as the destruction of Libya, is really plaguing U.S. foreign policy and relations, and it's going to be likely to be a big issue in the campaign. I've still not been able to, I decided I would watch it to try and understand what was happening. One allegation that the group at the, in Benghazi, the Americans, were laundering the Libyan arms that captured in the invasion, over to the groups in Syria. And, that may or may not be true. I haven't been able to ascertain for sure if it was true or not, but, The Benghazi story and another one, American Sniper, which I watched this week, which is arguably one of the most depressing movies I've ever watched, in part because I believe the U.S. government is responsible for the death of Chris Kyle, the famous Navy SEAL sniper who was killed recently, several years back, and the movie's about. We're seeing all sorts of instances where U.S. special forces have been killed or assassinated, I believe, by the American military or American government, and it's a very worrisome issue. I would love to see someone like Charlie Ferguson do a documentary about Libya, like the one he did about Iraq,
But I am worried that we are highly dependent on the U.S. Special Forces. And at this point, they could become more worried about friendly fire than doing their job. And that's not a good situation. The other thing is a point that Saker brought up, and I used it as our excerpt in the little Just a Taste. Where's the incentive to cooperate? Russia looks at what we did to Libya, what we did to Iraq, and says, no way, I don't want that done to me. And when we discuss Haiti with Dr. Cherry, we'll see the same thing. So, you know, the U.S. is increasingly looking like the scorpion in the story of the scorpion and the frog, and it's a bit scary. So we had our interview with Saker this month. He's doing quarterly reports with us. I'm so delighted to have him. Interestingly enough, he and Dmitry Orlov and one other Russian living in the United States issued a new warning, and they are very concerned about the possibility of war with Russia. And their article, A Russian Warning, is basically saying that. I put a quote up on the blog, quote, "We now feel that it is our duty as Russians living in the United States to warn the American people that they are being lied to and to tell them the truth. And the truth is simply that this, if there is going to be a war with Russia, then the United States will most certainly be destroyed and most of us will end up dead." Pretty blunt. I've always said that my concern is not the danger of global collapse. My concern is the danger of war. Why the U.S. is pushing the Russians as hard as they can, why the U.S. would really risk war is the question. And so Saker and I discussed that extensively. And there really is a conundrum here of where this could take us. And I think it's one of the reasons when I said earlier that the political risks are really weighing heavily on the market. This is clearly one of them. So enjoy the interview with Saker. It's very, very good. So that's it. In closing, next week, Dr. Laura Thompson, Detoxing from Toxic Vaccines, then Soft Revolutions with Wayne Madsen, former NSA officer, and very, very knowledgeable about what's happening politically in the world. And then Haiti and Disaster Capitalism with Dr. Daddy Cherry. We're really going to be focusing on the interview with Dr. Cherry and with Wayne Madsen on a lot of the tactics that are being used by the U.S. around the world to look like we're helping, but really invading and practicing disaster capitalism. So until next week with Dr. Laura Thompson, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.